The recall were manufactured and sold between January of 1993 and this past October. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
In London today, Britain begins the most sweeping inquiry by any nation involved in the Iraq War. Critics are hoping the hearings will expose alleged deception in the buildup to the conflict. Some are concerned that the hearings will do little to answer lingering doubts. A panel is expected to consider allegations that former Prime Minister Tony Blair secretly backed President George W. Bush's plans for an invasion a year before Parliament authorized military involvement in 2003. The panel plans to question dozens of officials, including Blair. It still also will seek evidence from former White House staff. Britain's participation cost 179 lives of British soldiers. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Siemens. From smart grid technologies to green buildings, Siemens is committed to answering the world's toughest questions at siemens.com/answers.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Common Ground Food Co-op, now at Lincoln Square Mall, featuring organic and local foods grown right here in Illinois. Learn more on their website at www.commonground.coop. Support for today's broadcast comes from Freestar Bank, locally owned since 1934, with 13 neighborhood banks in 5 communities throughout East Central Illinois. Freestar, where they are managed locally and decisions are made locally. Their newest branch is in front of Meyer on Philo Road in Urbana.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, it's pretty clear that attending college has real benefits for both individuals and for society, provided that students actually graduate with a 4-year degree. This morning, in this hour of the program, we'll be talking with two of the authors of a recently published book. The title of the book is Crossing the Finish Line, and it's a book that takes a look at completion rates at some of the country's top universities. The authors of this book looked at the experiences of 200,000 students at 68 colleges, including this one, University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, also some others in our region, among them Iowa State, Ohio State, Penn State, Purdue, University of Michigan, and University of Wisconsin-Madison. And what they found is that under 50% of undergraduates at these schools graduate in 4 years, and only 77% graduate in 6 years or less. And the question that they tried to look at is, well, why is this happening, and what can schools do about it? Our guests this morning are Matthew Chingos and Michael McPherson. Matthew Chingos is a PhD student in the Department of Government at Harvard University. He's a graduate of Harvard, has a bachelor's degree in government and economics. He does research on elementary and secondary education as a research fellow at the Program on Education, Policy, and Governance at Harvard. And also he does work on higher education as a research associate at the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation in New York. Michael McPherson is the president of the Spencer Foundation, and before that he served as president of McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota for 7 years. He is an economist, and his interest is the relationship between education and economics. The book, by the way, if you're interested in taking a look at it. It is published by the Princeton University Press and has a great deal of detailed information that I am certain would be of interest to anybody who is in higher education. We'll try and hit some of the high points, and if you'd like to explore this in greater depth, of course, you can go out and look for the book. Questions, too, are welcome here on the program. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, as we'd like to get in as many as possible, but questions certainly are welcome. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point, certainly you should feel free to join the conversation. Well, I'm Matthew Chingos. Good morning. Hello.
Good morning.
And Michael McPherson, hello. Yes, it might help to push the button. Michael McPherson, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks very much for being with us. Just to start out, I'd like to talk about the completion numbers that you found. And one of the basic questions I have is this. If you look at completion rates, let's say you go back 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, is there a trend here? Are completion rates have they been going down over time?
I should say that this is Mike. In our study, we focused on a single cohort, that is, people who started college in 1999. So we didn't study that as the major focus of our work. However, I think that the long-term evidence is that completion rates have been pretty flat and disappointingly low. Mm-hmm. But time to degree has gradually gotten longer, so that the number of people who complete by any given age, the percentage who complete, has been going down over time. Matt, does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's right. The number of people attending college has crept up a little bit, and the number of finishing college has crept up, so that completion rate has remained more or less flat. But Mike's absolutely right to make the important point that time to degree has gone up the last couple of decades.
And that's something that I'm sure that we'll talk about. But it sounds as if you would say that even though things aren't getting worse, that completion rate really is something that I'm sure people in higher ed administration, well, maybe you'd say they should be concerned with. Maybe they're not as concerned as they should be, but they should be concerned.
Well, the nation should be concerned. Mm-hmm. If you look at the last 100 and more years in the United States, there has been steady progress generation after generation in the level of educational attainment, the number of years of schooling people get. And that plateaued with the people who were born in the 1950s, so who would have been completing college in the 1970s. And we have seen very little progress since then in the overall education level of society. We kind of reached a certain plateau and stuck there, whereas the rest of the world has continued to push forward. We don't think there's any basic obstacle. It's not like we're educating everybody who's capable of benefiting. And for the future of the economy and the society, it is really important that higher education institutions and governments care about this and do things to improve it.
This study, your book here, looks at public universities. I wonder, do you have some data, or is there data that would answer this question? Do private universities do better, or is the picture similar?
Well, we focus on public universities because I think they've been understudied in recent years, and they educate something like 2/3 or 3/4 of undergraduates in the country. But we do have a little bit of data on private universities that we talk about in the book. And to the extent, I mean, it's not as comprehensive a look at privates as it is at publics. But one thing we do find is that 6-year graduation rates are pretty similar at public and private universities of similar selectivity. It's important to make that comparison of similar selectivity because we find such a strong relationship between selectivity and graduation rates. But looking at publics and privates of similar selectivity, they have similar 6-year graduation rates, but the 4-year graduation rates are very different. They're much higher at the privates, which means that time to degree is much faster at the privates. And that might have something to do with expectations. It might have to do with the fact that privates are more expensive. You know, you have to pay a lot more to stick around each additional year than at most publics. So that's sort of the key difference we find in the limited way we're able to look at it.
Hmm. One question here that seems to be obvious is that with the extension of this time to completion, do you think that it is the case that more increasing numbers of students think it doesn't really matter if I finish in 4 years?
I think it is becoming more of a normal expectation in public institutions that you'll take longer. Mm-hmm. And those expectations can be self-reinforcing. It's also true that universities haven't, for the most part, put a big priority in the public sector on finishing on time. You know, a lot of private institutions, you enter as a member of the class of 2012, let's say, and you know that's the target, that's when you're expected to graduate, and you'll focus on it. Public universities are more likely to have students, you know, taking various amounts of time. They don't have a clear identification with the class. But the fact is that this is costly to students. Not only do they or their parents pay tuition and living expenses for more years, but the chance to benefit from the degree, to get that better job, is delayed by taking longer. And it's costly to universities, too. The students who take longer wind up taking more classes, and they wind up using more seats and resources that could go to educating a larger population. So we need to get people, both the students and the institutions, focused on reducing time to degree as a goal.
Well, I wanted to go to the other problem that is maybe arguably more serious, and that is the question why it is that so many students start, but that they don't finish at all. It's not an issue that they take a long time to finish, but that they don't finish at all. And apparently significant numbers of students manage to get through their first 2 years, and then a big point for people leaving is halfway. So if you ask this question, well, what really makes the big difference between people succeeding and not, or people graduating and not, there are a number of things. Race, ethnicity, gender all matter, and we can talk about that. But it seems that right up front, one of the biggest things, one of the most obvious things that makes the difference is income level. And it is the case that more affluent students are more likely to graduate than those less well off.
That is certainly right. And I'll say some things about this because this was the major focus of my work on the book was on these financial questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's really clear that the most shocking figures in the book are if you look at college completion, bachelor's degree completion, for people from the bottom quarter of the income system, whose parents themselves didn't go to college, only 9% of those people wind up getting a bachelor's degree. 9%, less than 1 out of 10. If you look at the top quartile, among people at least one parent graduated from college, that figure is 68%. So you're like 7 times more likely to be a college graduate if you came from a high-income, educated family. One implication of that is that if we're going to have progress in getting more people through college, we can't just address those affluent people. We have to dig into this problem and understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of the income effects occur before you ever get to college. Students, have more difficult childhoods. They're usually in weaker schools with less experienced teachers. And so they come out of high school, if they come out at all, with lower qualifications. But even when you control for that and you look at similarly qualified people, income still matters. And we think that we have evidence that one reason for that is that if people have relatively low incomes and they face a higher price after allowing for their student aid grants that help them to pay for college, if they face a higher price, they're less likely to graduate than similar students who face a lower price.
Hmm.
So having generous financial aid or low prices for low-income students really matters to completion. But having lower prices and lower aid for the top half of the income distribution, as far as we could find, there's no effect there on completion. So our message is public universities and colleges and state governments and the federal government should target their resources on the people whose behavior will be changed by lower prices. And that's the bottom half.
Let me reintroduce the guest for anyone who has just joined us. We're talking with Michael McPherson. He's the last person you heard speak. He's president of the Spencer Foundation, and before that, he served as the president of McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's an economist who's interested in looking at this relationship between education and economics. Also joining us is Matthew Chingos. He's a now a PhD student in the Department of Government at Harvard, where he graduated with an economics degree and does research on education. Two of them are among the three authors of a book that's recently out, came out a little earlier in the fall. The title of the book is Crossing the Finish Line, Completing College at America's Public Universities. And as I explained, it takes a look at the experiences of a lot of students at a number of public colleges and universities across the country, and takes a look at this basic question, who finishes, how many people finish once they've started, and what can account for the fact that significant numbers of students who do start don't finish. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, we've talked a little bit here about a very basic factor, and that is the income level of students will tell you something about whether it's likely they're going to finish or not. I think it's also interesting that race, ethnicity, and gender all seem to play a role. And if you take a look at completion rates, and you can check me to make sure I got this right, Asian women have the highest four-year graduation rate, followed by white women, Hispanic women, Asian men, black women, white men, Hispanic men, and black men last. So I guess, you know, when you look at that, obviously there are some questions that jump out. Maybe one of the questions before getting to, you know, what's going on with black men, one of the questions that jumps out is, well, why is it that women do so much better than men? Is there an answer for that?
Matt, do you have an answer for that?
Yeah, I think the collective silence between Mike and I here suggests that we don't have good reasons or even good hypotheses about why that is. This was sort of this macro study comparing all these different groups of students, and you're right to point out that among every racial ethnic group, we find that women do better than men in terms of graduation rates, and it's partly because they show up with better credentials from high school, but only partly because of that. Even looking at women and men who did same high school grades, same test scores, they tend to do better. And it's I'm sure you could speculate why, but we don't have any concrete evidence as to why that is.
Hmm. You know, just to sharpen the puzzle, if you look over a long period of time, you know, the last 30 or 40 or 50 years, obviously the economic opportunities opened up to women have expanded tremendously over those years, and the economic return to investing in higher education is much higher than it used to be because there are a lot of good jobs. You know, there are now many women are able to become lawyers and doctors when they were not welcomed in those professions if you go back to the 1950s and 1960s. But the fact is that the economic returns are much higher for men as well. And yet men have not responded to those returns as women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're economists, and, you know, economists see a big incentive out there, and they see one group taking it up and another group not taking it up, and we don't know what to say. So, you know, we invite sociologists, social psychologists, and others to do the kind of small-scale qualitative work that might help us get a deeper understanding of what's going on.
Yeah. Here, I'm sure that for a lot of people, the big concern here when you look at these numbers is black men. What's going on? Why is it that they're dead? In terms of their completion rates, why is it that they're dead last? How do you explain that?
Well, you can peel back some of the causes. I mean, we know that black men, but of course this is like black women, come from families with lower educational levels than other parts of the population. We know that they come from families that have lower incomes. Those factors can be taken into account. We know that when, on average, with a lot of exceptions, when they graduate from high school, they have lower GPAs and lower test scores. But there's still a big puzzle because controlling for all those factors eliminates some of that gap, but there still is a remaining gap, and it is much bigger. The disadvantage that's seen in the data is much larger for black men than it is for black women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are not on average, and we always have to remember this is on average because there obviously are many black men who do succeed in college and many who go on to make huge contributions to our society. But on average, the uphill struggle that they have just seems to block more of them from success than is true for other groups. Matt, would you have something to add to that?
sort of one other just piece of the puzzle we find in our work is that this comparing, say, black men and white men with the same characteristics, as Mike mentioned, we find that there's still this this gap, even controlling for income and test scores and high school grades and whatnot. But one interesting detail is that the gap appears to emerge very late in college. Throughout the first something like 4 years of college, black men and white men with the same credentials are equally likely to drop out, or equally likely to persist is the other way to look at it. But starting past the eighth semester, after the four years have gone by, when a lot of the white men are graduating, a lot of the black men are dropping out. So it seems it's not just something connected to dropping out in the first couple of years of college. It's something that happens later on. But we don't have a good explanation for why that is, but it's certainly a fertile ground for further work by other people interested in these issues.
Yeah. Something else that you find, I think, that is interesting is when you break down the data, what you find is, well, if you, I'm sure that some people, if you ask this question, why is it that the black men are not doing better, and particularly compared to other, either compared to women or compared to different people who come from different racial ethnic backgrounds. Some people are going to say, well, it may well be that throughout the course of their educational career, elementary school, high school, they simply aren't prepared to do the work. They get to college and they're not up to the demands. However, interestingly enough, what you do is, and you do this, I think, for all groups, you look at the experiences of students at more selective institutions and less selective institutions. And so you would think that if you would go to a less selective institution, then that means that the work would be somewhat less demanding. And if that was the issue, you would think, well, they'd do better. But in fact, they do even worse. They do even worse at the less selective schools. And that shouldn't be. So gets you back to this question, well, any easy explanation about them not being able to handle the work, well, that's not that, – that doesn't work, because if you look at this, it would say, well, there's a problem here. And it seems to be the case that across different – if you look at comparable students, going to a more selective school actually makes it more likely that they will graduate. And I think that it's also true for other kind of students, that the less selective schools makes it less likely that they will graduate. Which again gets you back to this to the question, and I'm sure that you keep asking over and over again, what's going on here? Why should that be the case?
You know, this is a really big finding for us, and we think it has huge implications for policy. Matt really was the leader in this work. I'd like to encourage him to talk about what we came to call the undermatch problem.
Sure. So as you noted, there's this really strong relationship between the selectivity of the institution. It's a positive relationship between the selectivity of the institution and graduation rates. You know, similar students are more likely to graduate if they go to a more selective place. And one of the big implications of this is that where you it's not just important to go to college and to go somewhere, but where you choose to go to college is very important. So one thing that we talk about, and that's also been studied very extensively in Chicago by folks at the University of Chicago, is something we've come to call the undermatch problem. It really is a problem. And what we mean by that is there's this large number of students who do well in high school. They have the high school grades and the test scores, the qualifications that would be needed to be admitted to a highly selective college or university where they'd be very likely to graduate. But in large numbers, and disproportionately, students from poor backgrounds, from less educated families, from traditionally disadvantaged minority groups are not taking advantage of those opportunities. These are people who have overcome all sorts of obstacles in terms of doing well in high school, but they're just not taking the final step to enroll in a selective college. Instead, they're enrolling in a less selective college or a two-year college, both options where they're much less likely to graduate. So if some way could be found to encourage these students, particularly students from disadvantaged backgrounds, to pursue the options and take advantage of opportunities that are already available to them, then their graduate would be good for them and it would be good for society because they'd be more likely to graduate, and we'd also narrow disparities in graduation rates along socioeconomic lines that we've identified in this book.
Hmm. Well, I think this is an interesting point, and just to make sure that I'm understanding this, that again here what you're talking about undermatching, that is when someone chooses not to go to the best school they can get into. And it's something that seems particularly an issue with low-income students, although, again, and do tell me if I'm wrong here, that's true of any students, again, with comparable students, that going to a less selective school is disadvantageous when it comes to completion rates. Have I got that right? It sort of works no matter who you are, but particularly it works for low-income students.
That's exactly right.
It works no matter where you are in the income distribution.
Yeah.
But the thing is that upper-income students, not surprisingly, because they know the score, they know the system, their parents know the system, they figure this out, and they're much more likely to get themselves to that top-rated institution. Lower-income people have a lot more difficulty with that, partly because they may not be able to afford it, but as important, they may not know they can afford it because they're looking at a very complex aid system. They may not have good information from their high school guidance counselors about what are the right schools for them to be thinking about. They may feel culturally uncomfortable in a place where, you know, not many people from that neighborhood have ever gone, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there seem to be a whole set of obstacles that are getting in the way of a very important choice being made well. That's actually something that our team would like to address through an experiment in future work. And we think it's a big thing for the nation to focus on.
Just, I have a caller here. I promise I'll get to them. But I just wanted to come back and underline one point. There seem to be a number of reasons for this undermatching. There could be a number of reasons why one would choose not to go to the best place that you can get into. But is it correct to say that concerns over cost are the big one? Is this really about tuition and fees and, you know, all the other things that are costs associated with going to college?
You know, we don't have clear evidence on which of these different factors is more important, and our hunch would be that it varies a lot among individuals. A big fact is that particularly if you're talented enough and have a strong enough record to get into a really top university, you know, on the public side, into North Carolina Chapel Hill or California Berkeley, or on the private side, you know, in Illinois, a Northwestern university or University of Chicago. If you get into those places, you're actually likely to be in very good shape from a monetary point of view, because they give very generous grant aid that helps defray those costs. But an awful lot of people don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly the actual cost is a real problem. And as I said before, we have evidence on that. But mistaken beliefs about the cost are a real problem as well. But I don't know that we would say that I mean, I don't, you know, even though we're economists, I don't think this is all about money. I think there are a lot of other factors that go into these choices or into these information failures.
Well, I have now several callers, and we will get right to them. Let me just very quickly introduce again our two guests. Michael McPherson, he's the president of the Spencer Foundation. Before that, he served as president of McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota for 7 years. Also with us is Matthew Chingos. He is now working on a PhD in the Department of Government at Harvard. He's a graduate of Harvard, has an economics degree from there, a degree in government and economics. And both of them are authors. They're two of the three authors of a recently published book that looks at completing college at America's public universities. That is, basically the number we're talking about is the percentage of students who start, how many of them finish, and how many finish within 4 years, and how many finish within 7, and how many finish at all. And there's a lot of data and information in here. If you're interested, you look for the book. It's Crossing the Finish Line, and it is published by the Princeton University Press. Questions are welcome. We have several. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And start out here with someone in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
It's such an interesting show. I have two questions, and I'll take them offline, please. First of all, I was wondering if you were looking at the number of students who not only graduated, but graduated and were planning to go on to graduate school following their graduation at the institutions you looked at. And second, the question's a little bigger, but it sounds like something that you're speaking about is what people talk about with this extended adolescence, this time of youth drawing out with longer schooling, waiting for families. And I'm interested in that because I see that as less a biological or natural situation than one that's influenced by economic and cultural factors that it sounds like you're talking about in looking at what's happening in academia, what's happening in these institutions. Right now at the University of Illinois, which is a public school, tuition is $15,000. So I know that one of you is an economist and that it's not only the tuition that's making this happen, but to go to a school where it's $15,000 as a public school, lots of these students have to work other jobs. Their parents are losing their jobs. There's fewer loans. There's increased health care costs. And also, when they're thinking about graduating and getting out, there's fewer jobs for them. Either in their communities or in our nation, if they're thinking about going to graduate school, the structure of the university itself is changed, where there's fewer tenure-track jobs. We have more students in classrooms, so the class size is bigger. So I was wondering if you could speak to some of these cultural and economic factors that you think might be playing into this extended undergraduate experience. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, that's a lot, I know. Can you take on some of that?
Sure. I'll answer the first question, and the answer to the first question is no. We just, in our data, don't know which students went on to graduate school. So that was the easy one, and I'll let Mike do the hard one, the second one.
Well, no, I think the extended adolescence thing is interesting. At the same time, you know, I think you're absolutely right to point at a worry about excessive work while you're an undergraduate, making it difficult complete on time, and difficult just to do a good job. And that's a real problem. Unfortunately, although we had fantastic data, it's just really hard to get good information about how much students actually work. So that was kind of a missing piece of the puzzle for us. But we suspect, actually, that in some cases, students and their parents are too reluctant to borrow. I know that sounds counterintuitive when all the news is about, you know, the minority of people who get in trouble with their debt after college. But in many cases, you're really better off to take a reasonably high level of loans, but reasonable for what you're able to handle, and get out into the workplace sooner. Now, admittedly, right now, this is a perfectly reasonable time to try to stay in school. You know, I think if you're going to stay in school for 6 years, you'd be better off finishing with a master's degree, a bachelor's degree. You'll get the undergraduate thing done in 4 and then get a master's degree if you're not ready to go into the labor market when it looks promising. You know, I think we also have to say that there is an aspect here for some students, some institutions, of liking the undergraduate experience. Now, it gets harder to indulge that as costs go up. But one of us heard a graduate student thinking back on experience at a major public university say, graduating in 4 years is like leaving the party at 10:30. And, you know, there is a piece of that out there. There is also a piece of universities not being organized in a way that makes it easy to get through in 4 years. You may not be able to get the courses you need for your major. You may not get good advice early on about how you should be making your course selections in order to complete on time. And look, I mean, universities don't get rewarded for graduating people. They get rewarded for keeping bodies in the classroom. That's something that also happens.
It seems to me that, you know, thinking back on my undergraduate experience, that the advising was kind of front-loaded. And that once they got you started, it was, well, happy trails, you know, from that on. Right. By that point on, you're on your own. And it seems that particularly can be an issue for a lot of students, and that they could benefit from having someone all along the way kind of helping them out, advising them, saying, you know, keeping them on the path, keeping them focused, keeping them going forward. And that if something like that, and it might not have to be real intensive, but if something like that was more in place, and particularly for at-risk students, and I know there are some places where they've done that very thing, that can significantly increase the possibility that once a student starts, he or she will finish.
Well, I think it's what you're describing is particularly a big problem for first-generation college students whose parents didn't go to or complete college. Those of us who are old enough to have children who went through college and who are ourselves college graduates can think back at all the phone calls. You know, Dad, you know, I have this professor who thinks I should add a second major in another subject to the one I'm doing. You know, is that a good idea? Dad, you know, some students here write a thesis, some don't. You know, do you think it's worth it to write a thesis? So, now, I was a college president. You know, I presumably knew something about this stuff. But, man, you know, we forget what a complex and foreign place a university is if you haven't lived your life around one. You know, I'm always struck when I visit these campuses that I'm lost half the time because they don't even put up signs on the building. You know, they're not always the most welcoming places to folks who don't know how the game is played.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to some of the callers. Let's go to Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi, good morning. And my question is in regards to why very qualified minority students don't end up in the very high-tier universities and go rather to the lower-tier universities. And what I was wondering was, is there like a high competition for these students? Do the lower-tier universities aggressively recruit them and help them apply for loans? I mean, could part of the reason be that there's an intense competition for this type of student, the highly qualified minority? And thanks, I'm going to go ahead and hang up.
All right.
On the radio.
All right.
There certainly is intense competition for highly qualified minority students, but actually that competition is mostly at the high end, mostly in the selective place. And we think that actually one of the obstacles to more success is that we have a problem of every university trying to get these students for itself. You know, so, you know, let me, you know, imagine, you know, Harvard and MIT going after the same student, and they want to reach that student. They want to persuade them Harvard's the right place, MIT's the right place. What there's much less of is these universities getting together and trying to do an outreach about the idea of going to one of the excellent colleges that's out there, rather than each trying to go after their own little bundle of students. And there are a lot of this recruiting that's done one institution at a time is wasteful and it's self-indulgent. But I think probably it's not so much that the less selective places are recruiting aggressively is that they're kind of an easy default choice. After all, that's what most kids in this circumstance see their friends doing. You know, they are being asked to stretch themselves and get into foreign feeling environments that may not feel very welcoming. So, and they may not be getting very good advice. But I don't actually think that they're getting outcompeted.
You know, important point to add here is that it's not like minority and low-income students are applying to a wide range of colleges, being admitted by them, and then making a really considered decision. In most cases, these undermatched students we talk about, they don't even apply to a highly selective place that would almost surely admit them. In fact, two-thirds of these undermatches never even sent an application to a selective university. So it suggests that it's not like they're making this well-considered decision and then just choosing a university because of its recruitment efforts or one reason or another. It's that they're making a decision that's really just not considered that well and not that well thought out or that well informed, perhaps not through their own fault, but for whatever reasons.
All right. Let's go to another caller. This is also someone in Champaign, and it's line three. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you looked at people with disabilities at all and their graduation rates.
Well, did you?
No, that wasn't something we were able to look at in our data because we just couldn't identify which students were disabled.
Okay. I'm sorry. These are certainly worthy questions, and there is more attention to these important problems in the last 20 years than there But we don't have any contribution to that from our own evidence.
All right, let's continue. We'll go to Terre Haute. This is line four. Hello.
Hi there. We're talking about cost being something that may prohibit people from going to the university they want. Where do you see community colleges playing a role in this, where students can go there, say, to Ivy Tech for 2 years and then move on to some institution to finish a four-year degree and in the end have paid a fraction of the cost to accomplish that?
That's an interesting question. I'm glad that the caller raised it, because you do indeed look at the experiences of people who have transferred, who have done that very thing, who have done 2 years at a community college and then gone on to a four-year school. And one can understand why one would make a choice like that, particularly because of the economic issues. But it sounds like you've actually found out that that's not, if your goal is to get a four-year degree, that that's actually not a good strategy.
That's right. So it's important, I think, to preface the answer to this question with the, I guess, what might be obvious to a lot of folks, but just to say that community colleges serve a wide variety of functions, one of which is to educate students who want to transfer and earn a bachelor's degree, but they do lots of other things. So we do find that students who want to earn a bachelor's degree are best advised to start out at a four-year institution, because students with similar credentials, the same exact SAT scores or ACT scores and high school grades, who start out at a two-year college are something like 30 percentage points less likely to earn a bachelor's degree, 6 or 7 years later than if they just started right out at a four-year degree. So trying to save money by starting out at a community college, I think for the average student, is a bad idea, just because they're going to be less likely to finish. Once again, it's important to return to this point that community colleges serve a wide variety of functions, training people who only want to be in school for a year or two, or for, certificates. So it would just be unfair to expect community colleges to play a major role in producing four-year degrees, or students who eventually earn four-year degrees.
Now, though, and correct me if I have this wrong, just to make it that much more complicated, you did find, though, that if you're transferring from a community college to a selective college, that actually your chances of finishing are about as good as if you started there as a freshman. Is that not the case?
Yeah, that is the case. It's very interesting, and our compliments on how carefully you read our book. We have these two results, right? If you start at a community college and you do indeed get through to getting that associate's degree and then transfer to a four-year institution, your chances are then really very good. They're actually better than the chances of a freshman with the same qualifications starting out at that institution. The obstacle is that not many people make it through that path. That is the big problem, and experts on community colleges will acknowledge this readily. Community colleges just have generally a big problem with people finishing what they start. Just, whether it's an associate's degree, a certificate program, their persistence rates are quite low. So if you can pull off that two-step maneuver, get the associate's degree, and then go on, you're doing well. But if you're playing the odds and you ask, are you more likely to get to the finish line starting at a four-year or starting at a two-year, our evidence, and there really, I've become aware of three or four other well-done studies that also find that's just not a strategy. The two-year college route doesn't work out for a whole lot of people.
We have about 10 minutes left, and I want to thank the caller and want to try to get in one or two more. Just very quickly, let me also introduce our guests, Michael McPherson and Matthew Chingos. They're two of the three authors of the book Crossing the Finish Line, which takes a look at completion rates at America's public universities. They looked at the experiences of students at 68 colleges across the country, this one, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, being one of them, to try to look at completion rates, that is, the percentage of students who start who actually also finish, and how many finish in 4 years, and how many finish in up to seven, and how many finish at all. And it's something that is of real concern to people who are in higher ed administration, but I think that the authors would make the argument that it should be a concern to everyone when you take a look at the relationship between the strength of the economy and the number of people who have post-secondary education. Questions are welcome. We'll try to get in as many as we can. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Lovington on line one. Hello.
Hi. I hope I'm not asking a question that's been answered. You talk about they're not completing, are they not completing because they're grade failure, or are they just kind of fading away, or I guess what's the termination as far as they're concerned in this process?
Well, that's an excellent question, and maybe an obvious one. I should have asked it. And why is it that they don't finish? Is it because they're not doing well academically, or is it something else about, you know, the experience they're having that leads them to think they're not sure what the goal is? Or is, can you answer a question like that?
The experience of actually flunking out, you know, that great phrase, is not all that common. What seems to be the more frequent experience is, and this is, you know, I'm really drawing here mainly on other studies that are actually able to talk with students about what led to their decisions. Students often point to money as the factor in dropping out. And I think to some degree students become discouraged, they lose interest, they drift off into other activities, or, you know, they're working too many hours, just too hard to put the thing together. But it doesn't seem to be mainly the case that they are dismissed from the university because of a bad record. And, you know, if you think about it, in fact, the fact that graduation rates are higher for similarly qualified students at more demanding places suggests that the problems probably lie more on the motivational side than on simply failing grades. Does that make sense to you, Matt?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. And so if you ask this question, well, what's going on at the more selective schools? One thing it seems to be pretty obvious is that they are more competitive. Students are more competitive. They think, well, they look around and they see all these really smart, hardworking kids, and they think, well, maybe I guess I better get with it and try and perform at the level of what everybody else seems to be doing, so that maybe that there is generally a more competitive, maybe more serious atmosphere, and that can make a difference, and that's not, and unless elective schools, there isn't that kind of feeling there.
I think expectations are really important. You know, if you go to a place where the graduation rate's 80 or 90%, pretty much everyone's graduating, it's expected that you'll graduate. Whereas if you go somewhere with lower, you know, only half the people are graduating, every other person's a dropout. So if you drop out, there's really no stigma attached to it. You're just another one in the crowd.
Hmm. We'll try to get we're going to Mr. McPherson, you're going to make a point there?
Yeah. You know, one of my predecessors as president of Spencer went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, you know, a good number of years ago, you know, probably more than 40 years ago. And she experienced what a lot of people experienced in that era, which was the first day of school. All the students are gathered in the auditorium, and the dean says, look to the left, look to the right. Two of you are going to be gone next year. Not just one, but two. You know, only a third of you are going to make it through the first year. And she said, you know, what the dean thought he was doing was saying, this is a tough, challenging place. You better buckle down and work. Hmm. But what students heard was, you know, this is a place where a lot of people fail, and you're probably one of them. That's a very different message, right?
Yeah.
You go to Harvard, right, as Matt did, everybody graduates. Even people who hate Harvard don't leave because everybody graduates. So these expectations, I think, are a powerful thing.
Let's go and do at least one more caller. This is Champaign, line three. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on the junior college question. You talked about students with the same record, with the same background, and what would happen to them. But I would think that I'm pretty sure that junior college students and students that go to four-year schools while the sets may overlap, they don't overlap a lot, and that students that go to junior colleges are going there because, well, maybe for money, but also maybe because they're behind and they need a nurturing environment. And I've found that our junior college, Parkland College, is extremely nurturing compared to a four-year school. I started out with a degree in draft evasion, basically, in the 70s and 60s, and at a four-year school. And then I returned after 10 years and picked up a different field and went to Parkland. And the atmosphere is very different, and I think it's very conducive to students that won't make it, absolutely can't make it at a four-year school, and gives them a chance to make it. And so that your comparison was not really valid.
So I think there's a few points that can be made to follow up on this excellent question. So first, I should start out by saying our work comparing students who started at two and four-year colleges is based exclusively on data from North Carolina. So I can't comment on a particular place in Illinois. But in North Carolina, we find that on average, and the on average part is important because there are students even in North Carolina who start out a two-year and transfer and do well, perhaps because of a more nurturing environment being available. But comparing students who look the same going out of high school, the ones who went to the four-year are more likely to graduate. Now, the caller makes this important qualification to this result that you compare kids who look the same at the end of high school, but they're making a different choice. So maybe they look the same, but they're different in ways that we can observe. And luckily, we weren't able to do this in our study, but there are other scholars who have looked at the same question. And what they've done is they've compared students who started at a two-year college, not because because they wanted to or because of something that made them more or less likely to graduate. They did it because it was convenient. So they look at students who started at a two-year college because it's convenient, it's close by, and compare them to students who started at a four-year college because it was the most convenient option. So now comparing all these students who just sort of took the most convenient option, you still find that those who started at a two-year college are, on average, less likely to eventually earn a bachelor's degree. So I think they're the sort of important. And this has also been found using data nationally from across the country. So there certainly are exceptions. And we also, as we've talked about, find evidence that students who do transfer from a two-year college do well. But I think there's just a lot more bumps on the path to a four-year degree if you start out at a two-year college because you have to succeed in one place and then transfer and then succeed in another place.
We are going to have to stop at this point. My apologies, we have a couple of callers we can't take. There's much more, I'm sure, that we could discuss. There's an awful lot in this book. So I would certainly suggest that if people want to pursue this further, look at this in greater depth, that you should go and look for the book that I've mentioned now a couple of times. The title of the book is Crossing the Finish Line, Completing College at America's Public Universities. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Has three authors, one of them, William Bowen. He's the Professor Emeritus of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. And joining us here this morning, Matthew Chingos and Michael McPherson. Matthew Chingos is now working on PhD in the Department of Government at Harvard. He's a graduate of Harvard and a bachelor's degree in government economics. And Mr. Chingos, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Michael McPherson, he's president of the Spencer Foundation. Also before that, served for 7 years as president of McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. And thank you very much.
Thank you, and thanks to your callers who asked really great questions.
Support for the broadcast today comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, celebrating their 10th anniversary at 6th and University in Champaign, December 4th through the 13th. World Harvest features imported chocolates, cookies, cheeses, gift baskets, and party catering. Also through the holidays, daily food tastings with an expanded tasting on Saturdays. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. We will take a break at this point so we can bring you some news and update on the commodity markets. We'll be back with more Focus 580, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at the Chicago Board of Trade, wheat futures are off sharply this morning. As I looked at total open interest yesterday, it fell off the cliff a little bit and has been actually falling significantly this week. And I'm looking at the July contract right now, where the wheat futures is very close to testing its 20-day moving average at 565, currently at 586, and also looking at maybe a retest of a Fibonacci number of 572.5, which is the 61.8% retracement from the highs made down in October of this year back to when the highs were in August earlier in the year. But let's go ahead and look at particulars and see how they are trading right at the moment. And in Kansas City, December wheat is at 536.5, down 17.5. March, 551.25, down 19. CME December